Right, well, as we said yesterday, we're going to touch on maintaining relationships and some thoughts for developing relationships. And then we'll leave some time again at the end for questions and comments and input from you. First of all, maintaining relationships. There are three things, maybe four, but two of them are very similar, but three things that I want to just mention this morning as means of maintaining relationships. The very first one is time. If we're going to maintain our relationships, we need time. Now, there are exceptions to that. I know that there are people that I know, friends that I have, that it doesn't matter how little time I spend with them, every time I meet them, we're just able to pick up a relationship like that and to go on. There are very few relationships like that. Those are the exceptions. I used to feel that a friend of mine called Peter Lyne was one of those. I'd known him for many, many years. The very first time we met was at a prayer and Bible week in, I think it was in Capel Bible College, the old Ealing Bible College down south. I think they've sold it now. And it was being run by a guy called Dennis Clark. Any of you ever heard of Dennis Clark? He was one of the pioneers of the charismatic movement. He was the kind of very forthright guy, unafraid to say what he felt. Very prophetic. I remember at one of those prayer and Bible weeks, I stood up to give what I felt was an earth-shattering prophecy, and I gave it in a loud voice with trembling hand. You know, I got all the paraphernalia, got all the actions right, and I sat down thinking, wow, that socked it to him. And Dennis said, excuse me, brother, he said, do you mind giving that word again in a little quieter tone so that we can all sit back and listen to it and understand exactly what you're saying? I felt about that high, you know, and tried to remember what I'd said, in fact, this wonderful prophecy. But anyway, it was there that I met Pete Lyne, and we immediately flowed into a friendship, which developed over many, many years, and we enjoyed one another's company. He got married, and we got on well as couples together. And then he went to New Zealand, and everything was fine. But even there, in that kind of relationship, there came a time when, because of the differences in geography and the differences in emphasis that developed while he was in New Zealand and we were over here in England, there were some suspicions, some difficulties. And I remember how important it was for us when he came back to this country to sit down and talk through all of those things. And it didn't just take one meeting. It took four or five meetings for us to actually talk through the feelings that we had about what had happened while we'd been apart. And so even in those very, very good relationships, we need to be careful because we need time. It's not always the amount of time. I believe that the devil, if he can't stop us one way, he tries to stop us another. If he can't stop you getting into the church, when you're actually in the church, he will try to make you an over-the-top Christian, you know, 110% Christian. If he can't stop you from evangelizing, he'll try to make you into a sort of way-out evangelist. You know, you're making your placards and standing outside your children's school saying to prepare to meet thy doom or something, so that you bring discredit to the gospel. He'll try and stop you one way or another. And when you come to the knowledge that you need to spend time with people, you tend to feel that you've got to spend this much time. And if you can't spend that much time, then it isn't worth spending any time at all. I think many of us feel like that about prayer. We have read all the great books on prayer. Anybody read E.M. Bounds' book, Power Through Prayer? That's one of those old ones. It's an interesting book. I'm not sure whether I recommend it or not, because you can feel terribly condemned at the end of it. I read about these men that used to wear away the floorboards, you know, getting up before the milkman in the morning and all that sort of thing. And I managed it, actually, for 2 weeks. And I was about the biggest bore in Christendom, because I'd sort of go into the meeting and look pompous and talk about prayer and everything, and everybody used to go down the drain. So it wasn't very helpful at the time. But you tend to feel that if you can't give God that much time, then it's not worth giving him any time at all. And that is real rubbish. Because every minute that you can give to God, if you get up late in the morning, you feel condemned, and you spend the rest of the day feeling condemned until you can have your quiet time the following morning. That's not the way to do it. If you've got up late, the best thing you can do is say, Lord, I am really, really sorry. I want to get in touch with you now while I'm rushing to get dressed, running to get the bus. I want to get in a right frame of mind to get to work or do whatever I'm doing. And we need to get in contact with God in that moment of time. And it's the same in our relationships. A friend of mine was standing outside my front door and he was moaning about the fact that he didn't have enough time to spend with his children. And he was saying, I really need to spend time with my kids. I want to get them out for a day. I want to take them to the park and the leisure park or whatever it is. And he was going on and on about this. I said, what are you doing now? He said, nothing. I said, are your kids in? He said, yeah. I said, well, why don't you just go home now and read them a story? They'll probably be thrilled by that, rather than you sort of feeling that you've got to give them a day. You know, when we really feel we've got to give people time, we end up sort of boring them and being bored ourselves, don't we? Another friend of mine was visiting me one day and had to call me away from a game of Monopoly with the kids. And there we were playing on the floor, and he said, excuse me, can I see you for a moment, John? And I went out into the hall and we chatted for a few moments. And he said, why is it that your kids didn't moan when you came to chat to me in the hall? He said, if ever I'm playing with my kids and I get called away, they moan. And they say, oh, Dad, you're always this, you're always that. And I sort of stepped back for it for a moment and I said, well, I think the answer is that my kids know that I would rather be playing Monopoly with them than talking with you in the hall. I said, I think your kids know that you prefer to be counselling with someone than playing Monopoly. So that the minute you get up from the Monopoly table, they know you're likely never to come back again. Whereas they're saying, when I get up, poor old Dad, he's got to go and talk to Morris again, you know. So it's the question of what's in our hearts, isn't it? And it's not so much how much time, but it's the quality of time that we give to one another. And I think sometimes in our daily round, we can just take a moment to stop and put a hand on somebody's shoulder and say, how are you? How are you doing? And often that's enough when we feel that we've got to come around, set aside a couple of hours for coffee or something, and we've got a busy schedule and we just can't do it. So let's take the opportunity when it's given to us and give one another time. I hope you don't sort of look at me and think, what a wonderful man he is, because he obviously gets all this right. I have brought with me my humiliator with me. This is my automatic humiliator. If ever I begin to look as if I'm getting proud, I have this lady here that just keeps me humble. So it's not an area that I'm terribly good in, but nevertheless I understand it because it's one of my weaknesses. Two words, giving and receiving. You can call these two and three if you like, or you can just call them two. Giving and receiving. Jesus said it's better to give than it is to receive. But many Christians feel that it's good to give, but we don't expect to receive. And that's wrong. Because giving and receiving is a kind of circle. And if all you do is give and never receive, then that circle is incomplete. And you put yourself on a pedestal and people can't reach you. Jesus constantly gave out, but he was also willing to receive. Even in his evangelism, he used his weaknesses to get alongside people. Remember when he came to the woman at Samaria, the woman at the well, and he didn't get out his evangelistic manual and look up Samaritans or wells and discover, you know, the best way to deal with a woman of Samaria at a well is to talk about water. That wasn't how he did it. What Jesus was feeling after his journey was thirsty. And here was a woman, and there was a well, and there was a bucket. And he said, woman, give me to drink. And then he began to converse with her, and we don't know whether he got the drink or not. But he was ministering out of his need to her. And I think sometimes we look at our neighbours, and we never let them think that we've got any needs, do we? And it's always us that want to lend to them. It's always us that want to bless them and do something for them. And consequently, they feel, well, these Christians are up there on some kind of high pedestal and we can't reach them. Whereas if you have a need, if you need to borrow a ladder or you need to some milk or coffee, it's good to go next door and ask your neighbor, because that helps them to feel that they are ministering to you. And so giving and receiving are very, very important. You remember Jesus was able to sit and have the woman come and anoint his feet with oil and to be highly criticized for that. I'm trying to draw a parallel in these days. Yes, I was at a leaders' conference some three, four years ago, and I hadn't got a car at the time. My car, I'd had to sell it, and I was doing without a car, borrowing friends' cars, and it was a bit of a hassle. And somebody stood up at the leaders' conference and said, it would be great if we took up an offering for John, and perhaps we could give him something towards a car. And so these leaders got their heads together, and they gave an offering of £5,500. There was only 50 or 60 of them there, £5,500. And a friend of mine said, I know just the car for you. He said, I've seen it, I would like it myself, but I'm prepared to step back and you can have it. It's a second-hand 6 Series BMW, and it's up for £5,500. It's immaculate. It's been owned by the garage owner, and he's selling it because he's got another child coming along. It's a bit small for him and his family. And so here I am with £5,500 driving down, driving around in a white BMW. Well, the first places we had to go was Spring Harvest. And, you know, at the Spring Harvest at Prestatyn, they used to have the closed circuit television. And somebody rang into the TV or wrote a question into the TV. How is it that some of these ministries can drive around in such plush cars? You know, it's the same kind of attitude that Christians have. Actually, with my £5,500, I could have bought a Ford Fiesta, a new one, and nobody would have felt that I was over the top. The same kind of money, I could have had that kind of car. But that's the kind of thing that people do to us. And I think sometimes we find it hard to receive. We'd rather live on peanut butter and Marmite, like some of the folks in OM, and feel that we're being spiritual, than have those times when God wants us to abound and be blessed. One of the greatest lessons that we had to learn in our ministry was after probably 10 years of ministry and living by faith, as they call it. It's really dying by faith, if you know anything about it at all. It's not living. Well, he knows about it. When you laugh, you identify. Obviously, you're going through it at the moment. Well, anyway, we've been living by faith, brought up on George Muller, and George Muller never, ever mentioned money. He would, if he had a need, he would just pray about it and he'd never mention it. And that's how we lived for years. And God supplied all of our needs. Sometimes we were right down near the bone, but we never suffered want. But then we come and we've got a fellowship around us, a family of people around us. And as far as they were concerned, we were living by faith up here, and they were just the plebs sort of struggling to eke out a living by going to work. And one day some of the folks in the fellowship came to us and said, can we join you? We want to live by faith. We'd like to make our resources available to you so that we can all live by faith. If you have needs, feel free to ask us and we'll share in that way. And I remember Chris and I said, oh no, we're not, you know, when you're more spiritual or when you're a little wiser and older, you know, we can go down this path, but no way. At the moment, we don't feel that's right. And then we went into the worst period of time that we'd ever experienced financially. We went away through the summer on various camps. We arrived at a camp in the Lake District with an Anglican group, and we hadn't got a penny piece. And we were trying to survive through the week without, we'd got the five kids with us, without buying ice creams or anything like this. And they, obviously, they were aware that we hadn't got any money. So they gave us the ministry gift at the beginning of the week, which we were very grateful for. And we were able to sort of live through that week. But during the week, the car broke down. And so we had to put it in the garage. And there was a huge bill. Well, it was huge to us at the time. And so here we'd spent our ministry gift, and now the car had broken down. And I remember sort of waving goodbye to this group as they left the Lake District, and we were going on further north to another conference, and we hadn't got the money to get the car out of the garage. And so the most humbling thing in that area that we've ever had to do was to go to the warden of the camp, who his wife, who wasn't a Christian, and say, excuse me, could you lend us some money to pay for the car? We'll pay you back as soon as we can. And she said, yes, of course, no problem at all. But for us, that was the most devastating thing. And we moved on to the next conference where all our fellowship were and all the folks that had asked us if they could share in this way with us. And we got there and we realized that we had just been proud. And we got these folks together and we said, look, we're really sorry. Will you forgive us? God has really humbled us. We want you to come and to share with us in this life of faith. And there are about three or four girls living with us at that time. They're all school teachers. and they emptied their bank accounts, paid for the car, gave us some money so that we could survive for that week, and everything was fine. When we got home, it was the end of August, and they wouldn't be paid until the end of September. And I remember coming down in the morning thinking, well, at least now they'll know what it's like. You know what I mean? They'll be miserable for a whole month, eking out a living until they get their money again, which just shows where I was, doesn't it, in my attitude of faith. And I went down to breakfast that morning, and they were all sitting at the breakfast table with great big beams and smiles on their faces saying, great, isn't it? We're all living by faith now. And from that moment on, our fellowship came into a new place as far as money was concerned. People's attitude was very much that of Acts chapter 2 and chapter 4, where nobody counted anything they owned as being their own. We're responsible for it. We are stewards of what God has given to us. We need to make sure that people manage what we give them or lend them properly. But our attitude is that it's not our own. And so giving and receiving is very, very important. And some of you have learned to be givers, especially if you're leaders. People can knock at your door almost any time of the day or night, and that's great. But you've also got to learn to be able to receive, and sometimes that is much more difficult. That opens up a whole area, of course, concerning giving, which we can come into on this final point, which I've got serving. Serving and giving are very, very near to one another, aren't they? But I want to single out serving and underline it, because I think there is a difference. Every ministry, from the apostle right down to the humblest ministry, and I'm not sure it's the right way to put it, right down to the humblest ministry, because God says in his word that the uncomely parts of the body are those that should be honoured the most. And the unseen, the hidden gifts are the ones which we need to give the most honour to. And I think sometimes the one that stands up at the front gets the focus. And if he's or she is doing reasonably well, then he gets the glory. But the folks who are in the background, who have put the chairs out, who've set up the PA system, who have prayed the meeting through, don't get the glory. And in God's eyes, those are the ones that are going to get the honour and the glory. But so it's not so much down from the apostle. The apostle is first, if you like, in authority. And that authority obviously has to be the authority of the throne, which is the authority of a lamb that was slain before the foundation of the world. And that's what keeps the balance. God's authority is a throne, but it's the lamb that sits upon the throne. And any leader in the church, he needs authority, he has to rule, but he rules from a position of the life of Christ, which is of a lamb that was slain before the foundation of the world. Now, in the scripture, you can look this one up if you want to as a study, that everyone from Jesus through to the angels, through to all the ministries in the church, whether it be a ministry of hospitality or giving or whatever it is called a deacon ministry, a serving ministry. Jesus was a deacon. The angels were ministering angels. They were deacons. They came to minister to God's people. We are called to be servants one of another. And the other ministries will become redundant. In other words, when we come into the fullness of God's kingdom, we're not going to need apostles. We're not going to need prophets. We're not going to need healers. We're not going to need counselors. Because we will all have come to maturity. Those things will be unnecessary. And so if we are finding fulfillment in our leadership or in our gift or our ministry in the church, then we're going to be disappointed when we come to the kingdom. Because the kingdom is not about gifts and ministries and important people. The kingdom is about love and fellowship and serving. And the one thing that is open to everyone, not everybody can be a prophet. Not everybody can work miracles. Not everybody can have all the gifts, but everybody in the church can be a servant. And that's the one gift that is going to go through from this age into the next age, is the ability to love and serve one another throughout eternity. And so that's the thing which is preeminent. And we can serve one another in a variety of ways. We'll probably come on to that later on. But serving is the key gift. Now, I want you to understand that serving is not being servile. Jesus maintained a dignity. Servants in the scriptures, if you read the scriptures, you can begin to get a picture of what a servant is like. And Jesus was not servile. People didn't walk all over him. Even though he was crucified, he said, "Nobody takes my life from me. I lay down my life when I'm ready." And in fact, they came to take him at one point in his ministry. But he just walked through the middle of them. And they could not touch him. And sometimes we think that Jesus was kind of Christian doormat and that everybody walked all over him. That was not the case. If he gave himself to a situation, it was because he chose to. When people came knocking on his door, the disciples said, "Look, all men seek you, Lord. Evangelist paradise. You've made it, Lord. Everybody wants your ministry." And Jesus said, "Okay, let's go apart and rest a while." He was not going to be pressurized simply by the need. He was only doing that which his heavenly Father showed him to do. And I think some of us get into the leadership trap, the ministry trap, where we feel that we're available 24 hours of every day, and we become servile, and we are then on the road to crack up, break down, and falling apart at the seams time. That is not what it's all about. And part of our leadership, whether we're in a family, or whether in a house group, or whether in a church, and in our relationships, is to teach people to serve us as well. I remember it was Orville Swindle that said, not Orville Swindle, but Orville Swindle that said, "You can't tell a good parent until they've brought up their children, and their children have brought up their children." Because a good parent doesn't just bring up their kids to be good kids, but a good parent teaches his children or her children to bring up children who can be good parents. And so we have a task to do. And one of the things I had to learn through the giving thing was that nobody else was going to teach the people that God had given to us about serving us if we didn't. And again, that's a very hard thing to do, because you've got to be absolutely clear that you're not doing it from a wrong motive, that you're doing it for the benefit of those who you're serving. One of the pictures I had in connection with this was, I was asleep one night when things in the fellowship were really hectic, and Chris and I were sort of running around doing everything for everybody, and we were getting absolutely worn out. And Christine used to say that I was nicer than God. You know, it's typical English. If somebody knocked at the front door, I'd say, "Oh, do come in, you know, have a cup of tea, sit down, what can we do for you? We've got a problem." You know, and you'd spend all your life sort of running around the saints, and they got more and more self-centered, and that's not leadership. And I was laying in bed, and I got this picture of David in the cave of Adullam, because our fellowship was like Adullam's cave. We had all the dropouts and all the wasters and all the skivers and all those that were in debt. They all came to Adullam's cave. And that's what happens, isn't it? And all those that didn't want to be in Saul's thing, you know, they came to Adullam's cave. And I had this picture of David sort of welcoming the first guy in and sort of washing him down and taking his shield and bashing out all the dents and sharpening his sword and cooking some broth for him. And the guy was really appreciative, you know, and before very long he'd nipped off and brought two of his friends in, you know. And, yeah, this is great, you know, David does all the cooking, and David sort of blessed them and helped them. And in the end, David had not 3, but 30, and not 30, but 300. And I saw David sort of sweat pouring off him, you know, rushing around trying to help all of these men. And then the Lord said, "Is that the picture that you see in the scripture of David?" And I suddenly remembered all the things that I knew about David. And he did have 300. He did have 30 men that were next to him. He had 3 men that were really close to him. And in fact, those 3 men, when David actually once said, "Oh," when they're in the middle of a battle, he said, "Oh, for a drink from the well of Bethlehem." And those 3 men picked up a pitcher, and they fought their way through the ranks of the Philistines to the well of Bethlehem. They let the pitcher down into the well. They drew up some of that water, and they fought their way back. And I saw 2 of the men standing side by side with the one that was carrying the pitcher as they fought their way through to bring that water to David. And David didn't say, "Oh, I can't receive that. It's too costly. You risked your lives to bring me this water." He received it. And then he said, "I'm going to give it to God." And he poured it out onto the ground. Don't know how they felt after all that they'd done. No, I'm sure that they were very, very thrilled as well, because they really did have the sense that God was taking that sacrifice. Now, that's the kind of service that we've got to bring. But not out of emotional blackmail. You know, Jesus didn't get his servants, his disciples serving him because he was emotionally threatened. And I do all the work around here, when are you going to start doing it? That's not how we teach people to serve us. And a lot of us do that with our kids, don't we? We sort of say, you know, there's a lot of work to be done in the house, why aren't you going to do it? And I always appreciated Christine because she never put that pressure on the kids. She taught them to serve because it was right for them to serve. And she was an example of serving to them first, and that's how they learned to serve. Not because there was a lot of pressure and a lot of work to be done. And I think that's how we've got to be with folks in our house groups and fellowships and so on. So being a servant is not being servile. The other thing about serving, and Chris can come in then, is that serving is doing what the person needs done, not what you think they need doing. Someone came to help us do our garden. I quite like gardening, actually, but being away a lot, I gave up. I remember the day when I'd been away ministering and the garden was all overgrown. And do you remember that day when I was out there with the lawnmower, and we hadn't got a motorized one, we got one of these push things, you know, and I used to suffer from hay fever, and it wasn't very sharp anyway. It used to tear the grass out rather than cut it, you know. And it was getting dark, and I was out in the garden shoving this lawnmower up the lawn and down the lawn, ripping the grass off and pouring with sweat, and I got hay fever, and I felt of all men most miserable. And I looked down the garden path, and there in the house, in the back room, were all the saints drinking my lager and watching my television while I was out there doing a flipping garden. And I thought, there's something wrong here, Lord. I preached to them, I changed their nappies, and there they are drinking my lager and watching my television. And the Lord said, son, you haven't taught them to serve. Anyway, the long and the short of it was that we got someone to help us with the garden. And I have never touched the garden from that day till this. I don't do any gardening whatsoever. But the thing was, when he first came in, he decided that this garden wasn't very nice, and that it would be much better if those bulbs over here were over there and that tree over there was over here. And so he came in and ripped the garden all apart. And he thought that was serving. And we had to say, brother, that is not serving. Serving is finding out where we want the bulbs, where we want the trees, and doing that. That's serving. Serving is not fussing around someone. Do you remember Martha? She was out there making a cheese sandwiches, and she brought this great wadge of cheese sandwiches and shoved them down to Jesus and said, you know, have a cheese sandwich. You know what I mean? And as much say, if you don't eat that lot, you know, that's an insult to my hospitality. People are like that sometimes, aren't they? Christine's mum used to be like that. I'd walk in and she'd cut a whole blackcurrant pie in half, and she'd shove one half on the plate and say, get on with that. And so, being polite as I was in those days, I struggled all the way through it. And then when I'd finished, she'd put the other half on the plate, and I say, no, thank you. She said, what's wrong? Don't you like my cooking? Pressure, pressure, pressure. That is not serving. Serving is finding out what people need, what they enjoy, what they want, and helping them in that, providing, of course, it's ministering to their needs and blessing them. Christine.
I think probably because I wouldn't give John up, my mother decided to kill him off if she could. I want to talk a bit about personality, actually, when it comes to maintaining our relationships. God didn't make a mistake when he gave you the personality that you have. He gave it to you because that's the way he designed you. That's the way he decided you would be. And I think that I know that we're such peculiar creatures, because we're always forever trying to change our personality to become more acceptable. I'm not sure who we think we are becoming more acceptable for or to, but we're forever changing ourselves to fit in with some image that we've got from somewhere or other. And when it comes to maintaining our relationships, well, when it comes to relationships, I think your personality is very, very important. And you can get under tremendous pressure from looking at other people's relationships and saying, I haven't got what they've got. But the secret is to be who you are. To be who you are, and within that, to form your relationships. I suppose I've probably got the only grandchildren And that's a relationship that you have to work at. You can't expect your grandchildren to love you because they're your grandchildren. I don't believe you can expect your children to love you because they're your children. I believe that you need to win your children and win their love and win their respect, because their personalities, and they didn't actually choose to have you as parents. You know, that was an accident of birth. I think you need to work at those relationships. But I've probably got the only grandchildren, I should think, in Romford, whose grandma's idea of an outing is to take them to the theatre. But my grandchildren love that. And they think, you know, this is what you do with grandmas. But that isn't what you do with grandmas. It's what you do with this grandma. And they're going to have to learn that. They're going to have to learn to cope with my personality. We have to learn to give one another room. And I think we look at certain kinds of personalities and think, oh, well, everything's so much easier for them because they're outgoing and I'm the quiet type. But it isn't that much easier for the outgoing ones. It just appears to be so. A lot of us, I think, are also conditioned by our own upbringing. I was brought up in, well, really a village called the East End of London. And up until I was about five, I wasn't quite sure who my mum was. I thought I had several. And in whoever's house I fell asleep at night was the house where I went to bed. And that's how the East End was in those years, in the war years. And it has made me, I believe, it has conditioned me to be quite expansive. I can cope with a lot of people. I can cope with quite a lot of relationships. But that's my personality. You, there may be some of you here who can only cope with two or three relationships. And that's fine. Because that's how God has designed you. We haven't got to be all like, you know, sausages conforming to one design, so that we will actually find ways of maintaining our relationships in totally different ways, which makes it so creative. That I can tell you the ways that I maintain my relationships. I maintain my relationships by dragging one of my girlfriends out for a pub lunch. And they think, when I started to do it at first, they would think to themselves, oh, you know, a pub lunch. And then when we got there and we had it, they said, oh, this is nice, isn't it? I said, yes, you can give the washing up back, can't you? You know, get rid of it. And it's not all that expensive to do. But some of you wouldn't do that. You'd prefer to make a nice lunch at home and invite a friend to it. It's the same difference. You need to allow your personality to have room to move out into your relationships. You need to learn not to be afraid of yourself. You need to learn not to be afraid of one another as well. I was helping in a sort out with a couple of friends of mine recently, and the guy, his name is Martin, and he's been through public school, he's very stiff upper lip, and if he really wants to show his affection to you, he'll shake your hand very, very vigorously up and down. And I know that that's Martin showing his affection to me. And I said to him on this particular occasion when we were having this sort out, Martin, could I demonstrate my affection to you in my way? So he said, oh, he said, she's going to put her arms around me. He said, yes, I'll cope. And I did. I just gave him a squeeze. And then as we left one another, I shook his hand. And we need to understand that we do have personalities, that we do have different capacities, and that we need to be understanding towards one another. We need to know that somebody needs a bit of directive, like John was saying, the guy doing our gardening. I can remember when I came home from spring harvest, the thing that I loved about my garden were all my polyanthers. Is that the right word? Mm-hmm. Yes. And I'd got a small, narrow flower bed that's absolutely packed with them right round a wall. And he pulled the whole jolly lot up and had put something different in. And I had to go to him and I had to say to him, Brian, I love polyanthers. He said, bit untidy. Oh. I said, I put them there because I wanted them there. And he was really sad. He was really sorry. He went down to the manure tip, you know, to try and see if he could salvage a few of them and sort of shove them back in the border. But it's being yourself with someone. finding how you can communicate and explaining to people the way that you communicate. We need to make time for doing things together. But it hasn't got to be always the things that you enjoy. It can be the things that somebody else enjoys. And it can be painful at times. I mean, John goes through a lot of pain when he comes to the ballet with me. Because I love the ballet, and John thinks, what am I doing here? But he does it because he knows that I enjoy it. I mean, the week before we came, we went to see the Young Bolshoi, and he actually had to hire one of these penguin suits, you know, because it was evening dress. But he did it to bless me, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. You know, well, it wasn't very good ballet, actually, but that's another story. But I enjoyed the occasion. So it's maintaining relationships sounds a bit dry, doesn't it? But it isn't a dry thing. It's a thing that can give you great joy and great enjoyment, and you can really enjoy one another's company. I know that the single people that have been in my life have been an enormous source of joy to me and to my family. I can knit, and knitting is my hobby. But I don't enjoy teaching knitting, as it happens. I enjoy doing it, but I don't enjoy teaching it. And the single girls who've been in my home have actually taught all of my girls to knit. I haven't taught them to knit. But in teaching the children of my family, they have formed a relationship with them that I can now see, and I can see as a tangible thing. And some of my kids will turn to other people for help and counsel rather than to me. But that doesn't threaten me. That really pleases me. It blesses me. Because I can see that they formed relationships through doing simple things together. You can't do things that constantly that bore you, because you'll get bored in the relationship. But there can be give and take, that you can find that the giving and the taking is in the actual things that you do together. I can't stand soap operas. I wouldn't sit down and willingly watch them. In fact, when I find that the women at home are watching them, which I think is too much, then I might have a word with them. There are certain things I wouldn't do, if you see what I mean. But there are other things that I can look at people's lives and think, yes, I can do that with her, and I can make the suggestion myself. I can say, well, I'll come and do that with you if you like. And they look at you and they think, but you don't like doing that sort of thing. But you're doing it for the sake of the relationship and because you want to spend time together. The important thing is spending the time together and finding things that you can do to bless one another. So accept from God your personality. Accept it. Be glad in it and use it to really forge your relationships and to cement them together, so that people begin to appreciate you for who you are and you appreciate them for who they are.
Good. Okay. Time is sort of rushing on, isn't it? That's my fault. It took a little longer than I should have done at the beginning. Let me give you one of my lists again. Leave you a few things here for developing relationships. Developing relationships. I'm going to give you five words. The first is strategy. If we're going to develop relationships, we do need to have a plan to achieve our goals together. We need to actually sit down and say, what is it that we need to do with our relationship and how can we do it? And that can be everything from perhaps sharing in gifts in the church, being hospitable. Maybe God has brought two or three of you together to act as a base for hospitality in the church. Well, you can sit down and you can plan how you're going to do that. It may be, for some people, it's just simply doing the housework. I know that Kathy, my daughter-in-law, who serves Christine and I, has got two or three girls together in a fellowship, and they completely look after the home for us, so that when we go home, we don't have to do anything. And they plan that. They sit down. They have a strategy. They go shopping together. They do the housework together. And that is tremendous. It's good for us. It's good for them. And it brings people together. So we do need to have a strategy. If we're doing street evangelism, it's no good just sort of joggling along and hoping that something will happen. We need to have a strategy. We need to plan it. So whatever it is in our relationships that we've been called together to do, we need to spend time together planning. Having a vision is not enough. My mum was a great one for vision. She was a bit like me. She was a sentimentalist. I won't tell you how we discovered the difference between a romantic and a sentimentalist. Christine is a romantic and I'm a sentimentalist, and my mum was a sentimentalist. And my mum would sort of, if it was a nice day, she'd say, wouldn't it be lovely to have a little caravan and go up in the mountains or do this or do that? And she would dream. And I would get very cross with her when I was young, because I knew that she would never, ever do anything about it. She'd never save up, she'd never plan, she'd never buy, and we would never have that caravan. It was just something that she did. And that, as a young person, used to make me cross. So vision is not enough. Having the idea is not enough. I wonder how many people there are in this nation that would say, it'd be nice to start a business of my own. And they think what they would like to do, whether it's running a shop or having some kind of self-employment or whatever it is, and they think it through and they have a vision, but they never actually accomplish it. So strategy is important. The second thing is creativity. We need to look for ways to bless one another in our relationship in order to develop them. I've got down here common interests, and then I've got holidays. If you want to test a relationship, one of the best ways is to go to Aaron for 2 weeks. Not just one, for 2 weeks together. You can usually survive the first week. It's the second week you really start to get on one another's nerves. Fellowship holidays are one of the best ways of finding out whether you've really got fellowship at all. Or pile in your cars and go away for a couple of weeks together, and you'll find out what you've got. Hobbies. Meals together, projects in the church. Let's be creative about what we do and how we do it. One of my problems is that I can get lots and lots and lots of ideas. I have difficulty sometimes following them through, and I need help to do that. Some people are initiators. Other people are actually the folks that can make what you've initiated work. And that's one of the reasons why I'm a team leader. I can have good ideas, but I'm hopeless at getting anything done. And so I've got lots and lots of people in the team that are far cleverer than I am in most areas. And I'm not being humble there. That is the truth. In very many ways, most of the folk on the team can excel far better than I. But God has given me the ability to initiate things, to call them together, to provide a platform for them to be together. So we need to be creative in our relationships. Could spend a lot of time talking about that. But even in the menial things that we do, we need to be creative. I know if Christine were sharing, she would say that for those of us that are housewives in the home, and we've got housework to do, very often we treat it as though it's something we just want to get done. And that's the attitude we breed into our kids. And we perpetuate a wrong attitude towards things like housekeeping, housework, and so on. And what we need to do is to say, this is something that has to be done. Let's do it creatively. Let's try and do it well. And let's do it as unto the Lord. The third word is disillusionment. In order to develop a relationship, you have to be disillusioned. No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that every human relationship will come to a point where it suffers disillusionment. Gerald Coates talks about veneer relationships, disillusionment in relationships, and reality in relationship. And one of the tragedies is that most Christians live in the veneer. They meet up with people, they get on well for a period of time, find out what people are really like, see their clay feet, move on to the next relationship, and they never go through into deep relationships. There is no way that two people can walk together for any length of time without suffering disillusionment. That's the time when we need God's help to be able to see the relationship through. We may not only need God's help, we may need the help of others. Peacemakers, I call them. The book of Job actually is about peacemakers. Do you remember he had three friends that when he was down the tubes, three friends came and they ministered theology to him, they ministered the occult to him, they ministered philosophy to him, and they talked solidly for 7 days and seven nights. The only credit to Job was that he was able to talk them to a standstill. And at the end, I think it's in Job 30, 31, he sort of justifies himself and says, I haven't done this, I've never done that, I've never done the other thing. And all he was doing was hanging on to God by the skin of his teeth. Bible says you've heard of the patience of Job, and I used to think patience was a kind of holy virtue where you looked saintly and held your hands in a holy position, and whatever trouble came, you always had this sickly grin on your face. The patience of Job was being frustrated with God, was pouring out his feelings to God, but not actually giving up God. His wife came to him and said, curse God and die. But he didn't. He held on to God. And in the midst of that, when Job had exhausted himself, God sent a young man to really put him in his place. His name was Elihu. And he said to Job, belt up, Job. This is my version, the vernacular. Belt up, Job, he said. Be quiet. And if you shut up long enough, I will speak to you like God. And Job actually was quiet. And this young man brought him to silence. And then God was able to speak. God needed a peacemaker in that situation. And we need peacemakers. We need people that love us so much that they will wound us in order to bring us through. And disillusionment is the area which gives us the greatest opportunity to get into deep relationships. Now, I'm not saying we have to force our way through, but we do need to see that when we see somebody's clay feet, that's the time that we can really love them. Not ignore their weaknesses, but really love them and go through with them. Remember Noah, his three sons. When Noah got drunk, one of his sons mocked him. The other two sons took a garment and walked in backwards into the room. Noah had stripped himself off and he was naked. And they walked in backwards, refusing to look upon their father's nakedness, and covered over their father's sin. That's a tremendous picture, isn't it, of what we can do for one another rather than allow ourselves to be disillusioned. Fourth word, expectations. We all need to have expectations for one another. We need to believe in one another. One of the things I do when I see people, I see the potential in them. Young people particularly, I love young people. Even though I'm getting old in the tooth and grey, or what's left of it is grey, I still love young people and I can see potential in them and I can encourage young people. And it's important that we have expectations. But just recently, I've been learning that my expectations must not be written on a banner which constantly are flaunted in front of that person, because then our expectations are crushing. And I've realized that in my relationship with Christine that I've had expectations which have actually crushed her. I've realized in my relationship with the team and also with the local fellowship that sometimes my expectations crush people. They're not wrong expectations, but they crush. So we do need to have hopes. We need to have success and change, success and belief that people can change. But we must not allow our expectations to be crushing. And the Lord came to me and said, just tear up the placard. Don't lose your hopes, but tear up that external placard that you sort of wave at your team and at Christine and at your fellowship. The final word is submission. It's a dirty word, and I almost hesitate to say it at 25 past 11. But it is a scriptural word, and it is a word that we ought to see can bring us into security. Because submission is necessary if relationships are to function. Authority and structure are the means to get us where we're going. Authority in the church comes because we recognize gift in someone else. Doesn't come because somebody says, you've got to submit to me because I'm the leader. That's not the kind of authority in the church. The authority is if you see somebody can do something that you cannot do, then in that area of their gifting, you need to submit to them. And if you're a musician and you want to learn to play a musical instrument, you submit to somebody that has a greater skill than you. It's quite simple. And as we get to know one another, God will show us where we are to submit. And Ephesians chapter 4 says, submit to one another in the fear of the Lord. Having been filled with the Spirit, having had our gifts anointed by the Holy Spirit, then let's submit to one another. Now, we could spend a lot of time on that, but it's no hardship. If your car's broken down and you don't know what to do with it, it's no hardship to submit to a mechanic to get it repaired, is it? And that should be the same in the other areas of gifting in the church. So we've got to find our way through. We are not all equal. Thank God that we're not. Wouldn't it be boring playing tennis? You know, oh, jolly good serve. Equally good serve. Wonderful volley. Equally good volley.
Shall we finish this point now? Who's going to be play the winning stroke? You know, what a bore it would be, wouldn't it? If we're running the mile, we'd have to decide who was going to win today because we're all equally good. We're different, and we need to find out how we're different and glory in our differences. Do you just want to round off, love? And we've got hours and hours for questions, haven't we? Sorry about that.
Yes, I just wanted to say that one last thing about our relationships, that I do feel we must be prepared for change. That relationships can't stay the same, they shouldn't stay the same, but we get surprised by change when it comes. Particularly with our children, suddenly they're adult and we don't know how to treat them anymore. But we've got to be prepared for this change. There has to be a time when you're no longer mum or dad in the sort of eat your greens era. Now it has to be much more of, I do feel it would be good if you did eat your greens, but the choice is yours. And then finally, you don't say anything about the greens anymore because the relationship has changed. And it's the same in the church. That there have been young men and young women who have related to me as someone that they are looking up to, someone that they're following, someone who they see as having things that can be imparted to them. But there comes a point at which that person sometimes can go past you, and they're going on, and you can stand there and cheer them on, not feeling insecure, because they're doing the things that you taught them to do better than you could ever do them. That's the joy of having spiritual children, is that they, you know, you can have quite a few of them. You can have more than you can have in your family, you know, and if you've got 24 spiritual children, the chances are that somewhere there are, in that 24, there are going to be men and women who can do things an awful lot better than you can. And that should be a joy, not a threat. But the relationship changes. I was trying to think of a really good example for you, and I think one of them is Anita. Anita Trainer, she's a friend of mine. She's our headmistress of our schools, the senior school and two junior schools, and she's the headmistress. But it all started when I said to Anita many years ago, let us start a play school for the children in the church. And we started it. But Anita picked the play school up, carried it on. She went on and on to John about when were we going to start a school, and one day John said to her, thus saith the Lord, do it. And she's gone shooting miles past me and my idea of play school. She's now the head teacher in our school, headmistress in our school. But that doesn't threaten me. I think that's fantastic. But I'm really glad to have been part of the process. So we must be prepared for our relationships to change and not be threatened by it. So just to sum it all up, what we're really saying. Well, I suppose what I'm saying is, if you don't want trouble, if you don't want pain, if you don't want sort outs, if you don't want arguments, don't have relationships. Don't have them. Don't get married. Don't get married. That's one of the worst relationships, having arguments and sort outs in. Don't get married and don't have relationships. Stay an island. You're quite safe. Because if this is operable, you're quite safe, you know. You have your relationship with God, and God loves you, and your place is secure. But you won't bless God if you stay like that. That's what we're saying. That to get a blessing from God is to be saved, to know you're secure, to know that He loves you. But to give a blessing to God is to form relationships. Is to give Him a body of people that can become His bride. But if you don't want the pain and the agony, then don't go for the relationships. But I believe that you're people who want to bless God. And so you want to go into relationships. You want to see them through. And it isn't being hurt that is the difficult thing. It's what you do with the hurt that is the difficult thing. Because I can't say to you, you're not going to get hurt. Well, in fact, I can prophesy you are. I can actually, you know, say, thus saith the Lord, you will lose some skin in this if you go into relationships. But the important thing is, what are you going to do with the hurt? Are you going to let it fester inside? Or are you going to let it come out, and are you going to go on and build some more? That's the challenge of relationships, I believe, in the church today. Thanks very much. We're going to have some questions.
I remember yesterday I said I was going to mention something about Jesus and hurt.
Oh, yeah.
You just reminded me.
I did.
You remember when Jesus was on the cross, he was offered that sponge, which was the gall of bitterness, and he rejected it. That sponge was actually a kind of drug, that if he drank from that sponge, it would affect the whole of his body, and it would ease the pain. And I believe that whenever we're in a situation where people are hurting us, crucifying us, or damaging us in some way, the devil comes along and says, have a good old drink at this sponge of bitterness. And if you wallow in self-pity, you drink of that, then it does ease the pain. But ultimately, it causes a hurt within you that means you can never have relationships again. And I praise God that Jesus refused the sponge, and he went right through, took all the pain, and came out the other side, resurrected, clear, so that he could relate back to those that had rejected him. Father, forgive them, because they don't know what they're doing. And somehow we've got to find it in our hearts. It's going to hurt us, but let's find it in our hearts to be hurt, but not to receive that sponge of bitterness, so that we can come back from the dead, and we can say, Father, forgive them, and we can have a relationship in God's time with those people again. So that's all I wanted to say about that. There. Are there any comments or questions just while we're waiting to clear up? Okay.
What happens when people don't live up to your expectations?
Well, I think that's where we have to forgive, and we have to, or examine our expectations, see whether they were right. See, Ian Trainer is one of my best friends, and Ian worked for me for a period of time and said, I want to serve you and help you through a particular phase, and I had high expectations of that. The fact was that he didn't have the ability to do what I wanted him to do. He's a worship leader, he's not a great administrator, and he was trying to help me out, which was good, but he failed in his expectations, and I became more and more disappointed, and we were drifting apart, and we had to sit down, and I had to say, Ian, I'm really sorry, I've had, my expectations have been too high, will you forgive me? But if people have not met expectations that are genuine, then we have to forgive them. You know, it just depends which way around it is.